This is a supplemental podcast for the review for Philosophy 202, Theories of Knowledge. I promised to go over a few things which I didn't get to in our regular review session, and the first is volitionism. So volitionism is at the end of the chapter on belief and will. There's a small section there, but there's a lot of information packed into just a few pages. You should know the definition of volitionism in epistemology, which is simply that one has free will with regard to one's beliefs. And then there are two kinds of volitionism. There is descriptive volitionism, which is just the view that it's psychologically possible to form a belief through an act of will. And then there is prescriptive volitionism, which assumes that it's psychologically possible to form a belief through an act of will, but also that it's justified to do so. So obviously, if it's justifiable for you to do something, it's possible for you to do that thing. So prescriptive volitionism is the view that it's not just possible, but it's also okay or justified to form a belief through an act of will, to place a mental finger on the scales when you're not sure what to believe, and to believe for some reason other than where the evidence leads. There are two arguments in the text against volitionism, and they're both against descriptive volitionism. We had some particular arguments against prescriptive volitionism, which were arguments against Pascal and arguments against William James and Kierkegaard. But these general arguments against volitionism are both against the descriptive volitionist view, that it's even possible for you to choose your beliefs. The phenomenological argument against descriptive volitionism says that we experience belief as something which happens to us, not as something we do. So, as I said in class, you don't wake up in the morning thinking, I freely choose to believe my alarm clock is going off. I freely choose to believe that I was asleep and now that I am awake. It happens to you automatically. If you notice a sensation and you look up and you see your cat walking on you, and you say, do you say, oh, I freely choose to believe that's my cat, and my cat is walking on me and treading on the covers? No, you just automatically believe it. The same thing when you open a newspaper and read about current events. You might make a judgment that a story is biased and that it is presenting something other than the truth. But why is that? It's because of your experience. It's because of things that you have, perhaps you've noticed the paper giving an inaccurate portrayal in the past. And this is based on your sort of formative or basic experiences. And as you go through life, you form a theory based on your understanding of the evidence. But for each piece of evidence, it's not as if you make a decision about whether to believe it or not. It just seems true to you or it doesn't seem true to you. Now, you do something, namely if you can choose to think critically or uncritically, or you can choose to believe everything you read, or you can choose to believe things, you might choose to suppress your doubts, for example. And actually, this might be a contrary argument. You might say, well, people engage in self-deception and rationalization all the time, and that seems to show that people have some control over their beliefs. But the phenomenological argument says most of the time, when you're forming a belief, you're not consciously saying, I choose to believe this or I choose to believe that. You're not making decisions about what you believe, but belief is an automatic process with your perceptual beliefs and even with your higher level beliefs, which are based on some of your formative experiences. The logic of belief argument is a separate argument, which says that as soon as you admit or realize that you believe because you want to believe something and not merely because the evidence shows that it's true, you lose confidence in that belief. So as soon as you admit or realize you believe something only because you want to believe it, you lose confidence in that belief. So for example, if you believe, say you have a certain religious belief, and a person questions, well, how do you know that's true? And you say, well, that's just the way I was raised. And then the person asks you, well, if you were raised by Klansmen, would you be out burning a cross? and you might reflect on the fact that the way you were raised was an accident of birth. It has nothing to do with which is what's objectively true. And then you might say something like, "Well, my belief gives me comfort," and the other person might say, "Well, but do you think that things that would give you comfort are likely to be true, or are they ways of evading the truth?" And once you're forced to face the fact that you have no evidence for a belief, that you believe it for reasons other than evidence, you lose faith or confidence in that belief. Epistemic humility is holding your beliefs in a tentative fashion, not being attached to them as part of who you are, your identity. And that's an important term to know. Also, I don't think we had a chance to discuss this in class, but except for maybe in a few places. But there's this question about the value of having true or justified beliefs. And it's remarked in the text that there are many people who are financially successful, physically healthy, psychologically well-adjusted, but they have what most people regard as bizarre or fringe beliefs unsupported by the evidence. And so this raises questions about the value, the pragmatic or practical value of having true beliefs, because it seems that people are able to compartmentalize their beliefs about the 9/11 conspiracies or alien abductions or what have you, or psychic powers. And you might get people who, say, in their business dealings or in their investments, are very hard-nosed and practical and only invest things which have evidence in favor of their being safe and lucrative investments, but may be a little less cautious about evidence when it comes to their religious beliefs or their beliefs in the supernatural. And this seems that people are able to do that without having many harmful effects befall them, which would weigh against Clifford's belief that having unjustified beliefs is harmful. And it also raises questions about the value, again, the practical value of having justified beliefs and being fully rational at all times. It seems that as long as you're rational about things which really matter, people do have this ability to compartmentalize their beliefs and be rational with some of them, but some of their beliefs, but not with others of them. With regard to moral knowledge, there's a discussion at the beginning of the text, the chapter on moral knowledge, and it talks about a common argument that civilization wouldn't work without moral truths. And this doesn't mean that just because civilization would fall apart, if in fact it's true that civilization would fall apart without morality, that doesn't mean that morality is justified. It might be pragmatically useful, but that doesn't mean that there are absolute moral truths. It just might mean that morality is a kind of a useful convention which has helped humanity, but it doesn't mean there are absolute moral truths which are true in the same way as our beliefs about the empirical world. And I make the analogy with God. It might turn out that people believing in God has all kinds of useful effects. It might mean that it gives people a sense of hope and meaning. Perhaps people behave better because they believe that if they live a life of harming others, even if they don't get caught by the police or aren't punished by their neighbors in the form of disapproval or retaliation, they might still think that they can't escape God's judgment. And so they might behave somewhat better than if they didn't believe in God. That doesn't prove that God exists. It just proves that God is useful fiction. So in the same way, morality might be a useful fiction. People believing that certain things are just right and wrong might allow human beings to live together in a better way than if human beings didn't have that belief. We talked about Hume's emotivist or non-cognitivist view, which says that moral statements refer to subjective preferences and attitudes of individuals, particularly natural feelings of approval or disapproval, and especially the feeling of sympathy, which virtually all human beings have. So people tend to approve and disapprove of the same things because they do have this natural feeling of sympathy, which causes us to associate the sufferings of others with our own suffering, and also to a certain extent the success of others with our own successes. And so we want to see others do well as well as ourselves, and we disapprove of things which would be harmful to us if they were perpetrated upon us. And so it's not that we disapprove of people stealing only from us, or only from, or people assaulting only us, but we have general feelings of disapproval of theft, or of assault, or of murder, and not even just of our friends and our loved ones, but of people we don't even know. And that's the way our mind works. It works in terms of abstract general principles from our specific experience, but it all comes down to these feelings of sympathy that we have, which cause us to irrationally associate the sufferings of others with our own particular sufferings. The Euthyphro problem for divine command theory: does God command things because they're right, or are things right simply because God commands them? And we talked about you can't derive an ought from an is, means that you can't derive statements of moral value from statements of empirical fact. Modern ethicists use hypothetical cases and thought experiments to discern ethical principles from intuitions, in the same way that scientists use double-blind experiments. And then on the last chapter on political knowledge, according to the evidence, the ideological bent of both academia and the mass media is liberal or progressive, or left-leaning, which are roughly synonymous. And there have been a number of sociological and demographic studies of people who work in the media and have positions of power, as well as empirical studies of the news coverage itself, that all show, for various reasons, that you have this leftward tilt in both academia and the media. In academia, it's because of the 60s, and many of the college protesters went into academia, and you have the counterculture becoming the new status quo. Mass media, even though they're owned by large corporations, the content of the broadcasts or the print media is not determined by the corporate board of directors, who are only concerned with ad revenue and the bottom line, but rather by the managing editors or bureau chiefs, in the case of broadcast media. And those people come out of journalism schools, which are, again, left-leaning. And people generally go into journalism because they have a kind of a idealism. Now, of course, that doesn't mean that the truth about what's going on in the world is right-wing. It just means that when you're looking at MSNBC or watching The Daily Show or even listening to NPR, you should know that the people who determine the content are selecting material based on their political bias, and the slant of the stories is typically going to slant leftward, and you are not getting an objective picture of an issue or of what's going on in the world. And there was a recent case where an undercover journalist decided to do a sting operation and was masquerading as a member of the Muslim Brotherhood, wanted to make an anonymous donation, and all sorts of unsavory information came out from public broadcasting officials. And this showed not only anti-Semitism, but an extreme bias against people who have conservative ideals or values, and in particular, people who are members of the Tea Party movement. So when you hear high NPR officials referring to Tea Party movements as a bunch of white, racist, gun-toting religious wackos, you would expect that that attitude is going to color the coverage in particular stories on the Tea Party, but not in such a blunt fashion, but that attitude is certainly going to color coverage. So what do you do? You know, some people say, well, everyone has a bias, and just you should just not care about bias and go ahead and feed your own bias and let other people have their biases. But thinking objectively means trying to think from an unbiased point of view and to try to get to the truth which is hiding behind bias. So what do you do? Well, one thing you can do is get your news and commentary from a variety of sources. And if you know what your own bias is, if you're a liberal, watch Fox News and listen to Rush Limbaugh or Doug Urbanski or, you know, AM Talk Radio, Glenn Beck, right? If you're a progressive person. If you're more of a conservative person, you know, listen to NPR, watch Democracy Now, or listen to Radio Pacifica even, or MSNBC. That kind of getting your media from a variety of sources will help you find a kind of a place where you're not having people telling you what you want to hear, but you hear what the other side has to say about your views. On discerning which religion, if any, is true, there's a number of things you can do. You can examine the moral character of the founder. You can look at the validity of any historical claims a religion makes. The Western traditions have texts which make historical claims. You can look at the sacred texts or teachings and see if they are internally inconsistent or contradict known scientific truths. So there's a number of things you can do. And this idea that there's no objective way to investigate religion just seems to be a modern shibboleth. One thing to realize about political judgments is that you can't have a sort of notion that the best political philosophy is just the one that gets works. So the one that gets results. So political pragmatism is not really possible. Every political judgment assumes some system of value. Just to have the idea of what works or what's successful, you have to have an idea of what the goals of the state ought to be, or what the goals of a legal system ought to be. And those goals are not value neutral. And so every political judgment has some assumed values. And what those values are is a question of ethics. Aristotle considers ethics to be something which is empirical because, according to him, ethics is the art of living well and those character traits which lead to a successful life and a prosperous society. So Aristotle rejects this sort of dichotomy between what is good for you and what is good for society, and this idea that ethics is all about doing things for other people and sacrificing yourself. And what Aristotle says is that ethics is a matter of succeeding as a human being, to actualize your own innate potentials as a rational animal. And so to do that, you need certain character traits like integrity and self-discipline and ambition and skills of various kinds and also the ability to work with other people and to cooperate with them. And so Aristotle's view is that if each person has those character traits, together they will create a successful and prosperous society. So there is no dichotomy between what's good for you and what's good for everyone else. If you develop these own character traits in yourself, they will serve your self-interest and also be of value to other people. So for Aristotle, what it means to be a good citizen or a good employee or a good father or a good son are also what it is to produce a good society in both the natural and the moral senses. Going back to political knowledge, the American media is skewed towards domestic news. So because America is more isolated, say, than European countries, which border on lots of other countries, we have a neighbor to our far north and our far south, but are sort of over on our own and a very large nation. And so international news takes a second seat to domestic news. Also, news goes for sensationalism, negative stories, stories about things you have to watch out for, dangers. You don't see stories like food supply is safer than ever. What you see is stories which say, you know, salmonella scare, people are dying from eating peanut butter. And so even though very few people are affected by these occasional outbreaks of foodborne illness, What gets the press? Well, the outbreaks, not the fact that our food supply is much safer than many other nations and generally safe. And so people have, well, an unrealistic view how many child abductions are done every year, or how many murders and rapes are committed. Why? Because those are the things which lead the local news. Hume's greater miracle argument, I think, is the last thing I need to cover, and that's just that it would be a miracle if someone didn't make up a story to get your attention, or for power, or for their own amusement. Maybe they actually believe the fanciful story they told you, but they got carried away with their emotions or their fantasies. And so Hume says, whenever someone tells you a story about a miracle, ask yourself what the greater miracle is. And Hume is sort of ironically saying it would be a miracle if that person wasn't making up a story for ulterior motives, or didn't let the irrational part of their mind fool them into believing that something was a miracle when it really wasn't. Feel free to stop by office hours, which are the same as the regular term. So click my picture or my name any place in Moodle, and you'll see them there. And good luck on the exam. You have till Thursday at 5 o'clock to complete it. You need to arrive by Thursday at 4 at the latest. And the labs open at 8 o'clock Monday morning.